Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two. In the last episode, we talked about the settlement, the original colonization of the Pacific Islands, and today we're back to talk about some documentation of the amazing navigation techniques used by the master navigators of various Pacific Islands. I am really excited to talk about this stuff today because I've been reading this big, very important book on the subject that was published in 1972 by an author named David Lewis called We the Navigators that involves extensive interviews with and then direct sailing and firsthand observation of the navigation techniques of master navigators from the Pacific Islands. For example, a man named Tevake of the Santa Cruz Reef Islands and a man named Hippur of Pulawat in the Carolines. And today we're going to be talking about some of these specific navigation techniques.
Yeah. And again, these are the techniques of environmental navigation. So navigation at sea, on the open sea, conducted without instruments. And so, I mean, that's ultimately the really amazing part of this. But then at the same time, I want to stress something we mentioned in the first episode, that this is also not based in sort of a gut instinct, a kind of, well, I've been at sea enough, I kind of know what I'm doing. No, this is a science. These are techniques that were passed down from generation to generation, from skilled individual to skilled individual. And so, we see this continued on in oral traditions. But then also we've seen them recorded, especially in the last few decades. There's been a resurgence of interest in this, an effort to make sure that these traditions and techniques survived, and then also to use them to understand the history of the colonization of these islands by ancient humans.
Right. And one of the points that Lewis argues in his book is that the colonization of the islands of the Pacific was not driven entirely by random drift, say people getting blown off course by a storm or getting lost and then happening upon a new island, that instead he argues that a lot of these islands were probably discovered by deliberate exploratory probes.
Right. So let's get into some of the techniques then. We're going to start with what may seem the most obvious, and that is the stars.
There are a lot of amazing techniques to talk about, but this is by far the most important one.
Yes. So Pacific Islanders, specifically the trained navigators, they did use the stars. A trained navigator knew the positions of important stars and their relationship to islands by heart. They knew how the pattern of the stars changed depending on where you went and what time of the year it was. And they could also use the stars to determine latitude. So that's your north-south positioning. They could roughly determine where they were in relation to the equator based on the height of Polaris or the Southern Cross above the horizon, which they would measure, again, not using instruments, but using the human hand.
Yes, or sometimes I think also maybe parts of the boat could be used to sort of orient with the stars on the horizon.
Right.
So if you're unfamiliar with this kind of technique, as obviously most of us are, as I am, the mind is immediately boggled, right? You think, okay, how would I use the stars to find, I don't know, a city or something like that? You wouldn't even know where to start. But once you know what to look for, this actually becomes an extremely reliable method. And specifically, the really important guide stars here are constellations that are low in the sky, around the point where they are either rising or setting and can be easily associated with a particular heading toward the horizon. So you're steering your boat and you are observing the stars right around the horizon. So these would be either stars and star constellations that have recently risen or are about to set, depending on which direction east-west you're heading. So if you have a particular destination in mind and you know your starting position, you can associate your destination with a particular guide star, or what a guide star would actually mean is a series of stars and star constellations that will move vertically up and down across the sky as the night goes on. But they might be identified by, say, the first star you would see in the sequence as the guide star, and then the train of subsequent stars that would move up and down as the night goes on. But that is associated with a particular island. Now, of course, it gets much more complicated than that, because for one thing, you have to take into account position and geography, because while a star can help give you a heading toward a known island that it's associated with, it would only necessarily be associated with the island you're heading for from a particular direction, right? So if you're heading from east to west, the island you're looking for is under a certain star. But if you're heading from north to the same island, that island would be under a different star, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the stars help you get an orientation, but you have to know the relationships between a sort of mental map of islands in your head and how shifting the starting point of the journey will shift what star path will lead you to your island destination. But it gets even more complicated than that because, of course, as we mentioned, the stars don't stay still throughout the night. The Earth is rotating, so the fixed stars rise and set across the sky over the course of a night. And as the stars rise higher or set below the horizon, they become less useful or not useful at all for navigating without equipment and charts. Not just because, say, they're higher as they're rising up, but also because they tend to rise at an angle, so they won't stay right where they're supposed to be on the horizon. What you want is a reference star that is either just rising if you're heading east or is just about to set if you're heading west. So what do you do there? Well, what you would tend to do is cycle through new sets of rising or falling guide stars that you know will keep you pointed in the right direction. And Lewis writes about this, that on average, you won't need more than about 10 guide stars to sail through an entire night, given the amount of time that each star is usually pretty close to the horizon, close enough to be usable. So you can almost imagine kind of a, I don't know, like those like stock ticker strips, you know, the old one, like a strip of stars that are peeling up over the horizon all night long. And each one, you know, is the next one in the set that is still oriented with the top star in that strip that will keep you going in the direction you need to go. But stop and think about like how much memorization this requires, like how much you need to know about what the stars look like, what their orientations are, and their relationships to the islands you need to get to, depending on where your starting point is. So the amount of navigational lore that needs to be committed to memory and the amount of detail in it is absolutely astounding.
I mean, it reminds me a little, these are not directly comparable at all, but it reminds me a little of how in, what was it, Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi, talking about how an experienced riverboat pilot would need to know by heart the entire river, like all the various details of its twists and bends, its depth, et cetera, and everything that went into knowing it, which, from what I've read, you can basically take that and apply it to any kind of nautical setting, and certainly this one as well. Like, you would need to know by heart the environment through which you would be sailing, the environment of the waters, but also the environment of the stars above.
Yeah, and it seems that while the mental memorization of physical surroundings on land, including like trees and changes in terrain and rocks and landmarks and stuff like that, maybe this is just my landlubber bias, but it seems like that kind of thing probably comes more intuitively. It's more just sort of like a biological default to recognize landmarks like plants and rocks and stuff like that, than it would be to memorize the stars as your landmarks for guidance.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it almost feels like sailing through through space, though, of course, there's going to be plenty concerning the water itself and other environmental cues that we'll get to. But certainly at this point in the podcast, it's easy to almost think of these as space voyages because of the degree of focus that must be placed on the stars.
Right. And so experienced Pacific navigators can use these rising and setting guide stars to form this extremely accurate mental compass. Lewis gives one example of one of his voyages with the navigator Teveke. And he says, quote, by these obliquely sinking stars, he was able to inform me that during the evening that the wind had backed from southeast to south-southeast. I seriously doubted the accuracy of his observation until Canopus, topping the horizon on a bearing of 143 degrees exactly in line with our stern, confirmed that we were in fact dead on course and that the wind had changed. Now, there's another variation on the idea of guide stars for navigation that is known as the sidereal compass, that is basically like a view of the night sky that identifies particular rising or setting stars with points on an imagined compass. Again, this is not a piece of equipment, an external tool. This is a compass in the brain that has a picture, a mental map of the stars and how the stars along the horizon will give you information about north, south, east, and west. Now, these are the basic primary methods of navigation by stars, but obviously in practice, it's a lot more complicated. So a few examples. Of course, there is a lot of adjusting the course to compensate for variations in currents and winds and to be adaptable for celestial orientation markers when part of the sky is obscured, for example, by clouds. And I'll mention more about that in a minute. There's another thing that's a complication with the use of guide stars for navigation, which is the seasonality of guide stars. Now, of course, the availability of guide stars varies with the seasons because the sidereal day is actually 23 hours and 56 minutes long, not 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So each star rises and sets 4 minutes earlier each night. And as you can imagine, as this builds up over time, you're actually going to be having different star maps available to you as the year goes on. So in illustrating this, Lewis writes quote, Teveke told me that the sailing season in the Santa Cruz group lasted all year round and that there were appropriate steering stars for each time of year. Similarly, when Ve'etutu indicated the stars for the Nomuka-Tongatapu passage, he stressed that the ones he was showing me were usable only up to about September, after which new stars and sailing directions had to be used. So not only do you have to understand this whole star map and its relationship to the island geography, but also if you're sailing across different seasons, you have to have the seasonal backups in mind as well. Then there's even more to take into account. One thing, for example, is wind and leeway. So experienced navigators will have a mental map to reach their destination that must include compensation for leeway, you know, the sideward drift of a boat as it is blown sort of off course by wind. Mm-hmm. So if the navigator knows that the destination is under a particular star, but there is a known and relatively dependable amount of southerly drift on the journey due to prevailing winds and currents, they actually have to aim a certain amount north of the guide star.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Yeah.
And that's just for permanent drifts. There's also sort of more ad hoc compensation that has to take place along the way as well. But one of the big things that really struck me about this was how much it inverts the logic of nighttime navigation versus daytime navigation. You know, how would you think, what do you think would be the best time to try to get somewhere? Obviously, you would probably think it's in the day, right, when you can see where you need to go. But it is much easier to use the highly dependable celestial navigation techniques of the Pacific Islander navigation lore at night than it is in the daytime. There's still tools they use in the daytime, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But even when the stars are largely obscured by clouds, an experienced navigator can usually use some stars in the sky to orient and to get onto the correct bearing. For example, by noting which stars might lie at, say, 90 degrees to the course, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like you would probably want to leave the shore, around dusk, and then hopefully you're out to sea by the time the stars have come out, right?
Well, there's actually there's a good bit of thought about when are the best times to arrive and depart. So they talk about, I think it's usually customary to leave during the daytime. And one of the main reasons it's important to leave during the daytime is not only that people can be notified and you can say prepare things to take along with you that same day, like fresh food, and you can say your farewells to people during the daytime. But you can also look back at the island you're leaving from to get back bearings.
Right. So you can make use of the land for your navigation for as long as is feasible.
Right. And it's also usually considered important to arrive at your destination during the daytime, because one of the great perils actually of Pacific navigation is accidentally missing your target in the dark.
Oh,
right.
Wow.
If you sail past the island in the dark and you don't realize you've done it, that can be that could be a death sentence. So it's kind of interesting. While you're out on the open ocean, navigating at night is ideal. That's, where you get these accurate guide stars. But I think it's often considered good to leave the island during the daytime and to arrive at your destination during the daytime. And sometimes, and there might be some exceptions to that, but those seem to be some general principles that were observed, at least that Lewis mentioned. And so that would require very careful timing of the journey, right? Like, you need to know pretty much exactly how long it's going to take, how many days, so that you can time it out like that. And just as one example about the dangers of missing an island at night, Lewis talks about at least one of the navigators he worked with having a practice of, when you're getting close to the island and it's really dark out, sometimes they would just stop sailing. They would slow down. They would it's called heaving to. They would heave to slow the progress of the boat, just to be super careful that they didn't accidentally sail between two islands unnoticed in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But while the nighttime star navigation is the most accurate thing to use, there are clues you can use for navigation in the daytime as well. For example, you can use the sun. It's more difficult to use the sun, but it can be done. And it's more difficult for a number of reasons. First of all, there's only one of it, and its position can vary a lot over the seasons, right? Unlike the stars, the relative position of the sun on the horizon of Earth has a lot more variability. But even with the seasonal variability of the sun's position, you can still use it to navigate by pairing it with external reference to the stars. And this was one of the many moments in this book. It gave me that, like, oh, of course, kind of feeling. And this was one of them. So Lewis writes at one point about another scholar who had been writing about Pacific navigation, named Akerblom. He says, quote, "Akerblom surprisingly asserts that to achieve a satisfactory degree of accuracy when checking the course by means of the bearing of the rising or setting sun, the Polynesian navigator must necessarily have had access to some form of memorized table of the changes in the sun's azimuth." So it's, changes in rising and setting patterns over the seasons. But contrary to that, Lewis says all the navigator actually needs, of course, are his eyes and a knowledge of the stars. The sun-star comparison could be made twice in each day if one were so minded. So when the sun is rising or setting, you can check its orientation with respect to the stars that appear, before or after it, and then you can basically know where on the horizon it is rising or setting at this time of year.
Wow, yeah.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, there are other methods of maintaining core setting during the daytime that are, again, more difficult than the nighttime, but still possible. And another method that I thought was really interesting was steering by ocean swells. And there are actually two different uses here. So there's one thing, which is navigation by swells in the open water. So if you're out, you know, no sight of land anywhere nearby, you can use ocean swells to help you do direction finding, just like you would use the sun or the stars. But in addition to that, using the swells is actually a land finding technique. It changes in how the ocean swells are affected by nearby land masses can be used to locate islands that are nearby. And this is something we'll probably talk about more in the next part of this series. But what does it mean to steer by swells in the daytime? Well, swells are permanent wave patterns with specific cardinal origin points, which are associated not with waves kicked up by transient weather, but with strong and persistent wind patterns associated with specific permanent weather systems. For example, the trade winds, or what Lewis calls the southern ocean belt of strong westerlies.
Yeah, and I think we can sort of loosely imagine like a recreation of a basic form of this, some sort of a model or a simulation. If you had a body of water and you had, say, a fan or something creating some sort of a disturbance across the surface, and it was regular, what would happen if you then dropped some islands in there? It could disrupt the waves, especially in if we're talking in the actual ocean, in the form of long ocean waves as they bend around land masses. And this wave disruption can be identified by a skilled eye, enabling them to detect land hundreds of kilometers away, even, which is pretty amazing.
Right. And so that's the kind that would be used specifically for the land finding, right? Mm-hmm. But you can also use the sea swells like you would use the stars to get directional orientation, to know which direction is north, south, east, or west without a compass. Because if you know basically what direction a sea swell that is permanent and reliable comes from, you can detect that swell and then know, oh, okay, that way is south, southeast.
Right. So now we have not only the stars above, but also the wave patterns, the sea swells as well.
Right. So these permanent weather patterns, they originate in a fairly consistent direction from your location. Now, part of the ignorant land dweller in me is just incredulous here, right? Like when I'm out in a boat on the ocean, waves seem utterly random to me. I could not identify that waves are coming from a particular direction, you know. But they're not.
Well,
random.
Unless it's coming from a ski-doo, right? Then you or a, right. a motorboat that's coming by, then it's pretty clear what's creating the disruption.
That's a good point. But, you know, just the general choppy wave patterns of the ocean, I wouldn't have any idea what to do. But if you are trained in knowing what to look for, you actually can identify particular wave patterns or swell patterns. Lewis actually makes a distinction between waves and swells. But they're not just random. The system of orientation based on swells is not as reliable as the stars, but it's still pretty reliable. So the question would be, well, how do you detect them? One interesting fact is that the navigators Lewis learned from seemed to consult the swells based on feeling them in the body more so than looking at them, which means that they can be used to steer not only in the daytime, but on overcast nights. So when the stars are completely hidden, that's your main orientation tool gone, and there's no light to see, you could still potentially feel the directional swells and get an orientation based on that.
Wow, that's interesting. It makes perfect sense.
So how do you feel swells? Well, there's a part in Lewis's book where he talks about this. He says, quote, "Teveke told me he would sometimes retire to the hut on his canoe's outrigger platform, where he could lie down and without distraction more readily direct the helmsman onto the proper course by analyzing the roll and pitch of the vessel as it corkscrewed over the waves. In distinguishing swells," he stressed, "you have to wait patiently until the one you want has a spell of being prominent and discernible." So there is a lot of noise in the waves, right? So there's a lot of conflicting, you know, wave action coming in different directions. But there's a certain pattern you can recognize from a known swell. And once there's the right kind of timing in the wave action for you to identify the pattern of that known directional swell, you can orient based on that. And this would be, again, done by feeling it in the body and feeling the direction of the rolling of the boat. So when you think about how a boat moves in the waves, it can pitch, it can move up and down, forward to back, and it can roll from side to side. And the interaction of pitch and roll will tell you something about the direction that the swell is coming from, right?
Yeah.
Now, in saying that this type of navigation method is more reliable than it sounds, I also don't want to overstate or understate the difficulty of detecting it, right? That mm-hmm. there is a lot of noisy wave action going on in the ocean. So somebody has to be really experienced and know what it is they're feeling for in order to feel it. And I just want to read one section of Lewis talking about attempting to understand what's going on with the navigation based on swells. He writes, quote, "The course toward Talmaco was east-northeast, directly into the sea swell that came from the same direction, though it was only present or at any rate detectable occasionally. At such times it could be picked out by eye, and as the ship rode up and over it, meaning pitched, without any roll at all, except when the steep northerly wind wave happened to coincide, when the boat, the Isbjorn, was rolled to starboard at the same moment as she was pitching over the head-on sea swell. In those long intervals where the sea swell was absent, the wind wave rolled us to starboard about once every 5 seconds without there being any pitching component. I could feel little effect from the southeast or northwest swells. After nightfall, we steered by the stars, the swells remaining unchanged except that the wind wave declined." So that's about like trying to understand that there are different, in fact, there are multiple swells at any given time probably hitting you from different directions. And so the experienced navigator is looking for a particular type of swell, you know, that you could actually make the same journey potentially and look for different swells to steer you in aid of it. You just have to know which ones you're feeling for.
And that goes back to the example you mentioned earlier about just like sitting there or laying there on the boat and just waiting to feel the one you're looking for. It's not just, okay, the waves are hitting me, I got the pattern. No, you're looking for the specific pattern amid the noise or amid the waves.
Right, when there may be multiple patterns coming at you at the same time. You're just trying to pick the right one out, get the timing right to understand, yes, this is it. But as you were talking about earlier, I think it's important to remember, and again, we'll get more into this in the next episode, the ability to detect and measure swells and their direction of origin is not useful just in steering on the open ocean, but it's also one of the techniques for understanding when land is near.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a couple of other things that are really interesting about navigating on the open ocean. There's one more orientation technique that is even less reliable than the others, but it is sometimes still used as a backup that's known as the wind compass. So it's basically operating on the presence of known wind patterns to give you indications about directionality. So you might, for example, use the aid of a tool here, an external tool like a pennant, kind of flag object that would allow you to determine patterns of winds and where they come from. And if you know that there are certain dominant patterns of winds, you can kind of use that to give you another data point in orienting your boat in the right direction. Now, there's a whole other world of ad hoc adjustment that needs to take place on top of everything we've already been talking about. You know, basically everything we've been talking about is getting the correct bearing, knowing you're going mm-hmm. in the right direction towards your target island based on your starting point. But of course, in sailing, you can't always just sail in a straight line, right? Winds and ocean currents will gradually shift you off course, and you have to understand how that's happening and compensate for it. Which, again, this is one of those things where I just like react to that thinking like, it seems impossible. How could you do it? But but they have methods. They can do it. And there are a lot of methods here. But for example, one that I really liked, Lewis discusses on the first stage of one journey with Hippur departing from Pulawat, Hippur would keep track of back bearings on the island that they were leaving to see how the current was affecting their heading. So you'd have the reference point of the island landmarks, the island you're leaving, and then you can see from your heading as you're leaving the island how strong the current is at the moment.
Mm.
And then to read from Lewis here, quote, If, said Hippur, it turned out on further observation to be weak, we would head towards the point where Vega set, which is about at 309 degrees. If strong, as proved to be the case, towards the setting point of the Pleiades at about 285 degrees. Thus, there were at least two distinct star courses traditionally laid down for this passage, and probably four to allow for strong and weak south-flowing currents. This was a north-flowing current. So not only do you need to know the right headings for the island you need to get to under, you know, basically like neutral conditions, you also have to know what headings you would use if the current is a certain strength in a certain direction. And the corresponding guide stars, of course. But so if the wind or current is moving you laterally off course while steering in the open ocean, and so you don't have like, you know, back bearings like an island to refer to, how would you even know it? How do you know how far off course you're getting blown by the wind? This was another moment where the technique was revealed, and I was like, oh, of course. I thought this method was ingenious. Some of the navigators here would look at the wake left behind by the boat. So if leeway, meaning, you know, wind blowing the boat sideways in addition to forward, if leeway is affecting your course, one way to judge this is by looking at the degree of the angle between the straight line you're attempting to steer on. So you can imagine a straight line going from the stern to the bow of the boat, you know, and just going off toward the horizon in every direction. Look at the angle between that line and the trail of wake left behind you. This might be kind of hard to visualize without a picture, so I'm sorry. But Rob, I've got a picture for you to look at here. You can see that there's actually an angle of difference in between the wake behind the boat as you're getting blown off course and the straight line that you are attempting to steer on.
Yeah, you can imagine it as looking back and seeing not a straight wake behind you, going back to, just directly behind you as if it is a line drawn from the rear of the vessel, but something that is diagonal because of the way the wind is blowing the vessel from the side.
Right. So by seeing that angle and how large it is, a master navigator is able to correct for the amount of leeway that they're being blown off course. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Sue. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, there's a huge thing that we haven't gotten into in detail yet here, but a big section of Lewis's book is about the Pacific navigation forms of dead reckoning. And dead reckoning is estimating the position of your boat without reference to any new markers around you, but rather by knowing your past position and estimating how far you have traveled from there and in what direction. So this is crucial to keeping track of your journey, but this is a different thing because it's not giving you new information from your surroundings. It's rather a sort of keeping track of your position on a mental map by just using the information already in your possession. And one mental tool that seems to help with this process in Pacific navigation has been referred to as ETAC. Again, this is not a means of acquiring new information from the environment, but rather a visualization or a mental reference system for understanding one's place in relation to other things. Unfortunately, this is yet another concept that is kind of hard to explain without visual aids. But Rob, I've got a visual aid for you to look at here, and I will do my best to try to explain it. Basically, it hinges on having this mastery of relationships between stars, vantage points, and various geographical locations, specifically islands in the nearby surroundings. So as a point of analogy, imagine that you want to travel between New York and Chicago by stars. One way that I can help understand where I am along my journey is if I have a third reference point in mind. So let's say Atlanta. So I know that I start in New York, and when I start in New York, I know from where I am, Atlanta is going to be under star A from my point of view. So if I wanted to travel to Atlanta, I would head towards star A on the horizon. But by the time I reach Chicago, now because I'm at a different vantage point, Atlanta is underneath star C from my point of view. And there's a midpoint in between Chicago and New York where Atlanta, from my vantage point, is underneath star B. So the whole time I never see Atlanta, but this mental reference system allows me to break my journey into recognizable segments where I keep track of each time the third reference island, or in my analogy, Atlanta, has moved under a new star from my point of view. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And this visual reference helps a bit. Yeah.
I'm sorry you folks at home can't see it, but...
Actually, you know, if you do just a Google search for ETAC reference points, I don't think you will find the exact illustration that I'm looking at, but you'll see some that are similar that may give you an idea of what we're talking about.
It's ETAK.
Yeah.
Though it's complicated by the fact that this appears also to be the name of a like a car navigation system software. So If you Google Etak Islands, there you'll see the ride illustrations.
Yeah, that'll cut out some of the car stuff.
But I think this system is also really interesting because I think it still is important to think of it as a useful tool for navigation, even though it provides no additional information to the navigator. Instead, what it is it seems to be that it's useful as a system for mentally keeping track of the information you already have, for knowing how far you've come, where you are, and how far you have left to go. Which is interesting because, I mean, obviously that's an important part of any travel, right? Is sort mm-hmm. of visualizing the whole of your journey in ways that are not immediately apparent to your senses.
Yeah. And I guess as modern travelers with modern instruments, be it at sea or on land, yeah, we're still engaging in some level of that. We still have some level of a mental map, but we have these other tools that make our mental map less important. Maybe sometimes the mental map is even incorrect. Like, you know, if you're relying heavily on a GPS device to drive you from one point to the other, I guess you could theoretically not know if you're really driving north or west or south or what have you, mm-hmm. As long as the system got you there. But in this case, the mental map is everything. The mental map has to be carefully cultivated using knowledge of all of these environmental cues, these different systems. It's really quite amazing. It's something else.
So when you're driving somewhere new that you've never been before with the aid of a GPS, you know, like a mm-hmm. Maps app on a phone or something, can you just plug it in and go, or do you, like me, strongly prefer to look at the whole route first?
I tend to just go the same way I do recipes for meals. It's just, I just trust that I mean, I'll look and make sure I have what I need. Mm-hmm. In the same case, I'll look at my gas tank and make sure I have enough gas to get where I'm going.
Yeah.
I'll see how long it says it's going to take for me to get there, but then I'll just go. I'll just start cooking or I'll just start driving and trust that I will get there and I'll figure out on the way if there are any snacks.
This must be differences in personality type somehow. I guess I'm more annoying about this or something. I really don't like having to navigate based on just moment-to-moment directions on an app without seeing the entire route first. I like to look at the whole map, see what the steps are, see how far it is, see it visually represented. That really matters to me for some reason.
I mean, I might glance at it if I know there's going to be some weird exit, if it says that, oh, I'm getting off at this exit, and normally I don't do that. I'm kind of curious what route I'm taking then. But otherwise, mm-hmm. I just go.
Well, you know, the weird thing is, I think one reason I do that, it's not like it usually gives me important information that I actually need in addition to whatever the step-by-step instructions in real time are. Instead, I feel like it's something closer to the ETAC system, where I just want to be able to visualize in this abstract way the whole of the journey and sort of imagine where I am along the journey at various points.
Hmm. Yeah, but I feel like I'm going to do that anyway as I drive. Like there's kind of a perhaps less accurate version of that that's going to be going on in my head. But it's as accurate as it needs to be.
Yeah.
Like if the GPS satellites were to suddenly get taken out by aliens or something, you know, I could backtrack, or even if I've driven this particular route before, I can probably remember the rest of the way. But otherwise, I'm good.
Well, I wonder if we should call part two there and then come back in part three to talk about one of the next really interesting things, which is all of this has been mostly about navigation, direction finding and navigation, especially on the open sea. But a whole other part of this science of navigation is land finding. When you're mm-hmm. getting close to an island, how do you know that and how do you find it? And so let's save that for part three.
Yeah. Part three, we will make landfall or try to make landfall mm-hmm. appropriately. All right. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where you can find them, in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We have core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do a little listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form episode. We're calling it The Artifact. And then on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most of the science and the culture and just talk about a weird motion picture. And then we have reruns on the weekend.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.